Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, house prices saw a surprise fall in December, so what will 2026 have in store? Plus, we take a look at the red-hot areas where house prices are rising and falling the fastest. Also today, cash ISA rates are set to fall this year. Lee will let you know the pick of the bunch that you can open now. We'll talk New Year's resolutions, financial ones, notably how to retire a decade early, plus poor Costa losses mount as Coca-Cola searches for a new buyer. But is it time we fell out of love generally with overexpensive high street coffee chains? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. With the new year finally here and your New Year's resolutions confirmed, now is the time to take control of your financial future. With support from Charles Stanley Direct's Financial Coaching, led by This Is Money regular Lisa Kaplan, Financial Coaching gives you access to a real expert who can help you make sense of your 2026 financial plans. Book your free 15-minute call today at charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, make 2026 the year you take control of your financial future. Remember, investment involves risk. Now, back to the show. House prices suffered an unexpected slump in December, finishing 2025 only 0.6% higher than a year ago. That's a mere £1,642 rise. That's according to Nationwide Building Society. But the picture, as ever, isn't uniform across the country. So where did well, where fared rather poorly, and what does 2026 have in store for house prices? Lee, you've been chatting to the experts, but first, give me some of the house price figures. Isn't December normally a pretty rubbish month?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. I wouldn't say this is a complete surprise. I mean, given the fact that we've come off the back of a kind of strange year for the housing market, we had that period up until April where stamp duty was a little bit less, then the higher bands kicked back in again. Then we had the run-up to the budget, which we will not mention again on this podcast today, that hit the market quite a lot and hit confidence. But I guess the little surprise in it is that I think there was a kind of talk of it, the market uncorking, so to speak, after the budget, and there being a bit of a flurry of activity, etc. Mortgage rates have been softening a little bit, and the mood music a bit different. I think sometimes, though, you look at these things on a monthly basis and there's quite a lot of variables to it, and I don't take an awful lot of notice of the monthly figures from the house price indexes unless there's a massive slump or there's a massive rise. We look at it from more of an annual inflation point of view. Now, you pointed out there, 2025 as a whole, prices are edged up 0.6%, £1,642 rise. That's essentially a static year.
That is, yeah,
where not much has really gone on in terms of the property market. But this is according to Nationwide. And actually, Robert Garden, the chief economist in here, said that with price growth well below the rate of earnings growth and steady declining mortgage rates, affordability constraints ease somewhat, helping to underpin buyer demand. Indeed, the first time buyer share of house purchase activity was above the long-run average. So basically, what he's saying here is that it's been good news for first-time buyers. There has been a bit of a softening up in terms of being able to afford slightly bigger mortgages. Banks have been encouraged to stretch their ratios in which you can lend to first-time buyers. And we haven't seen runaway house prices like we have seen in previous decades. So you paint all of that together, and it's broadly a similar picture across all of the other house price indexes as well. But the key will be what happens this year and whether house prices start going up. There's actually an interesting little bit in here as well in the Nationwide price index, because obviously not all homes are built the same. Semi-detached houses saw the biggest percentage rise, up 2.4%, detached 2.2%, and terraced 1.8%. It's actually flats that are dragging down quite a bit of house price movement. They were down 0.9%. Flats have gone quite out of vogue.
It seems that flats, Lee, since COVID, certainly anecdotally for me and friends who've been trying to sell, but also from reading some of these reports, is that the case? Is it still the race for space as we talked about many times post-COVID?
I think there is a kind of tendency now, especially first-time buyers, they want a garden. You know, flats, obviously, sometimes you can have a downstairs flat with a garden, or you might have a balcony. It's not the same as having a garden. I think there's a big part of that. So not necessarily, I think the race for space in COVID was about getting way more space and like living in acres and things. This is like a mini version of it where I feel like first time buyers are shunning it. And let's not forget, the cladding scandal still lives in the forefront of our minds. That was a been a horrific period. So, I think that it has helped build this sort of first time buyers and buyers in general just aren't that enamored by flats at the
Yeah.
moment.
I remember we did a story last year just about that, how younger people are stretching themselves, aren't they, to get those semi-detached houses. So you're talking about different types of houses doing well, but what about, as always, different parts of the country? So where are the hot spots? Where are the not spots, Lee? And will that continue, do you think, because you've been speaking to the experts, into 2026?
Well, George, I'm going to lift a little bit into some of the madness that goes behind some of the stories that we create for both This Is Money and for the newspaper. So we had this piece this Wednesday in the newspaper, which was about the neighbourhoods where hottest, coldest neighbourhoods, and that comes along with an interactive tool on the website. So we've got the newspaper copy and we've got an interactive tool on the website. There was a bit of a problem with some of the data, had to re-crunch it all, but we got there in the end. And essentially, what we did, we wanted to build our own tool. So you can go if you go to dailymail.co.uk/neighborhood, you can tap in your postcode and find out what's happening in your local area. Now, the way we've done it is we've built a metric, and the metric essentially is about how much house prices have jumped annually and how many number of homes sold has increased to create a kind of very hot, normal, cold, or very cold market. Now, only three areas came out as very hot in our research. One of them is Halton, which is in northeast Cheshire. Then we have Oldham. Parts of Oldham have really, really shot up. And then we have Maldon in Essex,
Oh,
which is
yeah.
actually not too far away from me here. And I know for a fact that that is a hot market because it's become incredibly popular over the last 12 months. So we've taken all that data, and then we've got quite a few areas in here that are hot. And if you look at the map, the heat map of this, it kind of it's quite interesting. It's very spread out across the country as to where it's hot and cold. Whether that continues into the new year, I mean, that is the million dollar question, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of difficult to predict. I do think though that house prices in general will probably hold up fairly well this year. There's still this pent up demand of first time buyers trying to get into the market. I was having this conversation with my wife the other day. The £2 million mansion tax, it's easy to go, that's for rich people problems, yada, yada, yada. But it has a trickle down effect to the rest of the housing market because, someone that's selling a £1 million house might be looking to buy a £2 million house, and then someone selling a £700,000 house might be looking at that £1 million house, and so on and so forth. And it does rock a bit of confidence into the market. And also, there's other factors at play as well. For example, overseas buyers are just not seeing the value, especially in London at the moment, because the way that stamp duty is calculated now for them can mean absolutely huge amount of stamp duty. I think I saw an agent tweet the other day saying, essentially, why pay £300,000 in stamp duty when you could rent an absolutely like top of the range, apartment for 5 years for the same price as that stamp duty? And that where lay the problem, because you might say, actually, not having loads of overseas buyers flooding the market is a good thing. On the other hand, it can mean locking up the rest of the market. And also, in terms of like these heat maps and hot and cold, things can flip really quickly. One moment an area could be like underloved or, running cold, and then all of a sudden people see it as a value spot because it hasn't gone up as much as another area, and it could all of a sudden flip to hot very quickly. So it's a fool's errand, isn't it? If you're looking to buy a house, or you're kind of curious how much your house is worth, it's probably not a bad time to start sussing it out and having a look. As regular listeners to this podcast probably know, we are currently in the process of trying to buy a house, move house, and I thought there was going to be a flurry of homes being listed on Boxing Day and beyond, because that's what we've kind of been told. There was a grand total of about two houses that have been listed in the past week that are just completely not viable whatsoever. So, yeah, it just varies across the country.
So the search continues, Lee. The search continues. All right. Well, that's what 2026 has in store for house prices. It's not expected, am I right in saying this, Lee, to be a great year for savers? Experts reckon top cash ISA rates above 4% will not be hanging around for long this year. So get your skates on if you do want a good deal. Now, last year, we stuffed a whopping $43.1 billion into cash ISAs, due, of course, in large part to all that speculation that the limit would be cut in the autumn budget, which for under 65s it will be from April 2027. So this helped keep cash ISA rates higher than they would otherwise have been, according to Mark Hicks from Hargreaves Lansdown. So does that mean, Lee, the bottom is about to fall out, rates are about to drop?
Yes, that's what that picture looks like. And I always think, as a very, very, very sort of broad rule of thumb, if rates are kind of over what base rate is offering, like quite often you can expect it to sort of tip the other way. And also, when savings rates are being inflation as well, it's kind of like the magic mix of it's probably going to mean that savings rates are going to fall. ISAs, as you say, have become the real darling of our financial arsenal, I would say, over the last 12 months. I remember when we did a podcast at the start of last year, and I was saying about the speculation about cash ISA limits being cut would result in people stuffing their cash ISAs and actually doing the very opposite of what the Chancellor wants, and that is focusing on cash ISAs rather than investing, because they were thinking this might be the last year to fully utilize cash ISA limits. And that is going to be the case this upcoming tax year. It's going to be the last chance to use that full £20,000 limit if you're under 65, to completely use your cash ISA. Now, again, you could say rich people problems, not that many people max out their cash ISAs, but those who do typically are additional rate taxpayers, for example, who have no personal savers allowance. So any interest that they earn on their savings incurs tax unless it's in an ISA. And there's other examples of people that come into money and utilize these. So what that means is I'd get your skates on, essentially, and find the best deals. And we've done a little roundup here. Trading 212 is currently the best cash ISA. Doesn't cut rates for withdrawing money. It does include a 0.68% bonus, which lasts for 12 months. Then it goes down to 3.6. It's a flexible ISA. It means you can move money in and out of it. Trading 212 is FSCS protected, but what it does is it splits money between partner banks. His partner banks are Barclays, NatWest, and JP Morgan. So you have to be careful if you've got savings in any of those that you're not going to be breaching your new £120,000 limit, which is going to affect very few people. But if Trading 212 is not for you, not interested in going via an investing app, Atom Bank has 4.25%. You can only open it by downloading the app and opening it there. Then we've got Investec Save 1 year fix at 4.3%. Aldermore offering 4.13% on the 2 year fix, and Lifetime ISA is still rumbling around, but we don't know quite what the future is going to hold for Lifetime ISA. 4.25%. Now, if none of those float your boat, just have a look and see what your bank is offering. It's probably going to be pretty poor, but it just depends. And it's better than, let it languish elsewhere. I would just get your skates on and get an ISA opened and sort your finances. What a perfect week to do it, Georgie. Yeah, start the year strong.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, got an end of year, start of year question, whichever way you want to look at it here from a listener. My financial position is good in that I earn decent money, have some savings and investments and a work pension, but I'm not on top of them all and could probably make my money work harder. What would be your advice to help me sort my finances out in 2026?
I would say get on top of it. And what that actually means is if you've got old pensions that you've left behind as you've changed job, find them. Find out where they are, how much they are, and critically, how they're invested. And consider, do you want to simplify life for yourself by bringing them all together? You can save money in terms of charges, and you get sort of a coordinated investment strategy. And the same goes, you may want to look at your cash ISAs, see where the best rate is and put them all together. Stocks and shares ISAs, if you've got a few littered over the place, put them all together in one place that works best for you. I would say as well, consider making a bigger pension contribution if you can afford it. It's a good time to get on top of things.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Welcome back. It's that time of year where, fueled by optimism, we set ourselves resolutions. obviously, being a money pod, we are focused on the financial ones. Lee, do you have a New Year's resolution, financial or otherwise, Lee? Because I can't imagine a man of your standing in the finance world would need to have a finance New Year's resolution. Probably just more of the same, isn't it?
Oh, just more of the same, always, Georgie. I'm always trying to build my wealth and, you know, do the right things. But I am partial to setting like a little goal or a little challenge at the start of the year, or a shift of habit I like to think that I could achieve. Or it always has to be achievable. If it's not achievable, then I think it's just, you know, obviously setting yourself up to fail. So I've got two for this year, Georgie. Number one is to buy all of my meat from the butchers / local farm shop.
Nice.
Because I don't know if it's just me, but I have noticed in the last year, I think that the quality of meat from the supermarket has gone really downhill. I've kind of really noticed it because since the summer, I've been using a little local butcher in a farm shop to buy things like chicken breasts. And the quality, in my opinion, is superior. Yes, it comes with a higher price tag, but I've decided in this phase of my life that it's actually justified and worth it. And my second one is 2025 was an awful year for me for reading books. I'm an avid reader. I think that last year I dropped the ball a little bit. I think partially because we have a second child in the family and my attention span has dipped somewhat. And a lot of my reading comes from splitting my time reading Peppa Pig books to her. And also... currently on book 7 of Mallory Towers with my eldest daughter, who's now 7. And my brain has just like gone to mush reading these. You know, it's Enid Blyton, but my word. That's where a lot of my reading time has gone. And then my commute, etc. I've just found it hard to concentrate. So anyway, last week I did what I do when I go through. I don't have writer's block. I have almost like reading block. And I do what I do to get back into the reading habit. And that is read Stephen King. To pick up a Stephen King book, and I've just finished reading The Long Walk, which is a kind of very bleak book to get back into it, but I sped along with it and I realized that this year is going to be the year that I'm going to utilize the library much more. My daughter utilizes the library, gets lots of books out, reads and takes them back. I don't, and I've realized that part of the reason I think that I've stopped reading as much as the past year is that I've reached peak book in terms of the number of books I own in the house, and the thought of bringing more books into the house makes me kind of shudder because it's just more clutter. So I'm going to use the library more, read free books, and they are both achievable.
Clutter.
What about you, Georgie? What about you,
clutter.
Georgie?
Clutter.
What, yeah, clutter, but clutter.
Clutter. Even. As a woman who, you know, enjoys, well, I don't know if I enjoy renting, but I've certainly rented a lot in my time. My books were always the first thing that I would put up to make myself feel like home. There's no such thing as peak book for me. I think I bought 15 over Christmas and got given one as well. I don't have a problem with the amount I read. I probably should read a little bit less. Get out there more. Be more sociable. That's my New Year's resolution. Jointly, I actually, after a couple of glasses of fizzy pop on New Year's Eve, wrote a little list of things that I want to
achieve.
That's
not a little list. That looks huge. That looks like handwriting of a madwoman that you're showing up to me at the screen.
I mean, Lee, I'd had a couple of glasses of fizzy pop. I couldn't, but none of them are very good. I mean, they're things like do a bit more social media, which I haven't really done that much.
Anyway. I'm on the opposite end of that.
Don't do any. I've got, because I'm spending a lot of time in Toronto, I've got visit 5 North American cities that I haven't been to before. Watch the NHL at 3 new stadiums. So I thought that was a good one because I've been to quite a few.
So you've got into the ice hockey out of all the American sports that you're getting into in Canada. You've gone.
Well, do you know what? Funnily enough, Nee, as we go off and diverge this conversation away from money, but it's not because it's very expensive, by the way, going around the world and watching sport. But ice hockey, weirdly, or hockey as they call it out here, was always the one that I had seen the most, bar football, which is weird because I still don't really understand what's going on. It's a bit fast for me, and I haven't got the greatest eyesight. I just like the atmosphere, you know, it's fun. And because I've been to quite a few now, I thought, yeah,
that's,
I'm going,
nice,
my
goal.
Aim, go to all of the NHL stadiums across Canada. Yeah. So there you go. That's what I'm going to do.
Can you go and watch the Pittsburgh Penguins? Because I randomly have a Pittsburgh Penguins hat and I've got no idea why I've got one. And then people always ask me why I've got a Pittsburgh Penguins hat. And I don't know where I got it or why I've got it. So I'd like to think that you could put that on. I'm making up your New Year's resolution list now.
Yeah, all right, Lee. I haven't got space on my little sticky post-it, but I can write on the back. But yeah, because last year I actually did set a target for myself, a financial target for how much I wanted in my pension. And do you know how much I was off by? About £50. So there you go.
I wasn't far off. Yeah, that's fine. I think within margin of error, I think that's fine.
So I think that there's nothing wrong with if you do want to set yourself a little goal like that, to do, financially speaking, to do it. I think the really important thing, though, is a little tip is if you do mess up, quote mess up, you know, let's say you do dry January and then you have a quick drink on January, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Just keep going. Accept the fact that you're going to make mistakes along the way and don't probably make them so unbelievably difficult that you will never realistically achieve it, because then you'll just feel bad about yourself. Maybe that's just me, Lee. I don't know. I
totally agree with you. Yeah, that is the way. If you make it too unachievable, or say, this time next year I'm going to have £1 million, or something completely bonkers, it's more about thinking about it on a monthly basis, I think. Mm. For example, I want to have a savings pot by the end of the year. Well, all you got to do is get off your backside, open a regular saver, and it doesn't matter if you're going to put in £10 a month, £50 a month, £200 a month. It's going to be a nice little bonus when you get to this time next year, and you'll thank yourself for it. And that's what I always think. I don't set many financial goals because, as you rightly pointed out right at the start, I practice as I preach and just try as hard as I can to have as financially secure future as possible. But I think it's nice to have a goal, and especially think for something like savings, or it might be the year that you decide actually you are going to give investing a go. And there's lots of simple ways to go about doing that and getting on with it. But I think a lot of it is just getting off your backside and doing it. And if it's not this week, it doesn't matter. If you end up doing it next month, or you end up doing it in April or May or June or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's just about getting on with it and doing it.
Amen, Lee. Amen to that. Because it leads us on, though, to why we're talking about it. We're talking about it because it's New Year's. But, some people have a more modest goal, and that's absolutely right. Even if your goal is just to open that regular saver, like you said, perhaps get £500 into a saving pot by the end of the year, a very worthy goal to have. Others may want to do something a bit more extreme, completely overhaul their finances. And we're hearing a lot, aren't we, Lee, about people who want to retire early. And I don't mean like 1 or 2 years, like a decade early. So I spotted on your website, you have this ultimate 10-step guide on how to retire at 50. Now, obviously, if you're 50, that ship may have sailed. But still, Lee, there's plenty in here for everyone. And there's also some stuff here if retirement just feels really out of reach. So, Lee, what's this all about?
Yeah, so there was some research from a financial group, Brown Shipley, suggesting that the goal for many adults now is to retire at 60 or even younger. An early retirement usually means stopping full-time work in your mid to late 50s, around about 10 years before you can claim your state pension. Now, before we wade into this, there's a lot of things that you need to remember about this. It takes a lot of planning, it takes guts, and it takes perseverance to do this. If you fail to plan, you do face a real risk of running out of money during retirement and having to return to work again. And also, sometimes I don't know that many people that have retired, but if you do retire too early, you might end up regretting it, because you might be someone that doesn't know how to fill their time properly, and then you can start getting down a kind of getting bored, basically. And I'm not saying that work isn't boring at times for certain people and what they do, but it gives you purpose, and it's a massive decision to take. But again, if you set your goal to say that I'm going to retire at 58 and you're now 45, and then you end up not retiring at 58, it doesn't matter, because you've probably put all of the foundations in place that mean you could if you wanted to. And I think that's the way to look at it. I could do it at this age if I wanted to, because I've put all of the plans in place. So we have this 10-step guide. So step one is to define your goal, which essentially is thinking about the age you're going to retire and whether it's what you really want to do. Now, some people get complete job burnout, Georgie. They have a very stressful, high-pressure job, and they know they want to exit by 50. Part of the problem is what keeps us going, especially in our 40s and 50s, is that's when our earning power is probably at its highest. And you kind of think, oh, I don't want to forfeit all of that massive wage. So we end up kind of doing it. Often, no hard rule of thumb here, but for example, your children might be now thinking about flying the nest if you've had a family. So you have all of these little factors in play. Step two is probably the most crucial, which is working ha out how much you will spend. So we've talked about the Pension UK's retirement living standards a fair few times. A single person would need £31,700 a year currently for a moderate retirement, and a couple would need £43,900. For a comfortable retirement, you need £43,900 for one person or £60,600 for two. And that includes factoring in your state pension, but you need to work out where you're at with that, and how you're going to achieve it. Is it going to be, it's going to probably be a combination of your private pension, state pension, and savings and investments. And it's all about using all of the tools that we have, all the calculators that you have at your fingertips now, to kind of work out roughly where you're at. Now, step three, I think, is really interesting, and it's about Bengen's rule, which was created by an American financial planner called William Bengen in 1994. And he calculated if you want to have enough money in retirement and never run out, you should take 4% of your pension pot in the first year and then a similar amount each year, only increasing it by inflation, so that hopefully the money that you have left invested will just keep growing over time and making up for the withdrawal. Now, he's actually revised this rule recently and suggested the pension could withdraw up to 4.7% and remain safe, whilst those looking at a longer retirement, such as those retiring at 50, withdrawing 4.2% instead. I've actually got, I'm going to call this the Boyce rule. I've got something similar to this, which I'm doing at the moment, which is but with a holiday fund. So in the pandemic, I actually started with a £300. In the first month of the pandemic, it was a £300 I was saving on the commute, and I stuck it in a regular saver. I maxed out that regular saver, so over the year I had plus 3 grand. I then put that 3 grand into a simple tracker fund, and I've been adding £300 to it ever since. The goal is to get a certain amount in that pot that I earn enough interest to pay for the annual family holiday, and then carry on putting £300 a month into it. But it's almost like free money because hopefully the pot would be back again, and then it's like having a free holiday. Does that make sense? I'm almost there with it. I'm almost there with it. It's the Boyce rule of
Lovely.
holidays. So having a certain amount of money in an investment pot, you can withdraw a certain amount of money from it a year, spend your holiday on it, you carry on paying your monthly sum into it, and it will be round about the same amount of money again. Yeah, I think that makes sense. It makes sense in my mind. Anyway, step four, max out your state pension. I think that one goes without saying. You can go and check on the government website to make sure that you're going to be on track for your 35 years of national insurance contributions to get the full state pension. You can make extra contributions for missing years if you won't have enough. You can go back 6 years to fill in gaps. So make sure that you're going to have state pension. Don't know what shape that's going to be in. If you're currently in your 20s, 30s, or even 40s, could be pushed back further. Who knows? Get all your pensions in order. I think a lot of people do lose track of their schemes and what they're in, changing jobs, etc. So make sure that you are on top of all of that. And then once you've kind of got all that together, is to fill in the gaps and probably start to save about as hard as you can into your company pension, because quite a lot of employers will match contributions. Some of them will go further, double them. You just need to see what the state of play is with your current state pension. To build a pot of £500,000 between the ages of 20 and 50, you'll need to contribute around £600 to your pension. But not all of that needs to come from you. And I know someone's a big advocate of getting this message home. To get £600 a month, the higher rate taxpayer would need to pay £360 into their pension each month, on which they would receive £240 in government tax relief. So food for thought. Look at those figures, look at those numbers. Step seven, get the rest of your finances in shape. Make sure you've not got loads of debt. If you've got a mortgage, are you overpaying it? Get you into a stronger position. Step eight is to avoid lifestyle creep, which I think is, I think we're basically, the more we earn, the more we spend, and it's about keeping on top of that. And actually, I've kind of got myself out of lifestyle creep, I'd say, in the last year or two. But I was definitely falling a little bit to this because, I'll be honest, in my early 20s, mid 20s, wasn't earning very much. I was quite in debt, in terms of student loans, in terms of credit cards, all of that kind of stuff. And then I kind of got in my position where into a position where all that was paid off, much more comfortable. And I remember thinking when I was at university and kind of like shortly after that, wouldn't it be nice to go to the supermarket and not have to track every single penny that I'm spending. And I think I've not taken that to the extreme, but it's that kind of like, I'm going to put that in the trolley, that in the trolley, that in the trolley, and not even like tot it up in my mind. I was definitely going through a little bit of that because I felt comfortable enough to do it. And as someone that grew up in relatively not great financial surroundings, you can see how it happens. So it's essentially making sure that you don't just like blindly spend money on stuff that you don't need. Review regularly, make sure that your investments are working hard, your pension's working hard. Sometimes default funds aren't absolutely great, so go and do your research into that. And then step 10 is considering semi-retirement. And I think this loops it all the way back to where I was at the start of this. Retiring at 50 could be seen as a drastic step, but you might be looking to like wind down your career, but not stepping out of work entirely. So you maintain a level of income, but you're working less, and you might be doing something that's more of a passion project. I was doing that rare thing that people don't really do these days, and I was talking to a neighbor, and she works really, really, really hard. She's really high up in what she does in a career that she's built over decades. It means quite long hours on the road. And she told me just before Christmas that she's stepping back. She's retiring from that job 4 years earlier than she was anticipating. And her real passion is her garden. She's got a lovely garden. It's absolutely beautiful. And she just wants to go and work in a garden centre. I think that's a great path to take. You've really worked hard, you've put in a hard yard. I mean, obviously don't know her finances, but I'm sure she's in a nice position in terms of her pension and in terms of property and all that kind of thing. And she's ready just to not completely step back, but go and do what her heart desires. And I like that lesson in that as we go into the new year.
Yeah, if you're in that position, that's, absolutely lovely for you to be able to do that. I'd say two things briefly to what you've just said, Lee. There's a lot in that, obviously. I'd say the first one is for self-employed people. I am self-employed and I will bang the drum for the self-employed. This is on you, I'm afraid. We have got to dig a little bit deeper. And when you think about being paid, factor in obviously paying tax through that, but think about paying your future self. It's something that I have been absolutely evangelical about over, particularly with my own savings over the last, oh, I don't know, since I became a financial journalist about 15 years. The more you can and the earlier you can, you speak there, Lee, about employer contributions, but also think about the investment growth. The more effort you can put in, the more the money will work for you. So that's what I'll say about self-employed people. And the second one is the lifestyle creep, which is absolutely true. Inevitably, we do it. But I also think there's something to be said about value because, Lee, a little bit earlier, you spoke about getting really good quality meat. Obviously, if you can afford to do that, it's worth it. It's about getting value for your money, whatever that may be. And it leads us quite nicely onto our next story, because this is a story that's actually got really a lot of traction on your website. But it's more a business one, really, than a personal finance one. But it did get me thinking about the way we spend money. This is about Costa. It was once the darling of coffee chains. And I know that because I used to work there. It was regularly voted number one coffee chain. But losses there have more than doubled, according to its latest accounts, up to December 2024. Now, they're blaming challenging conditions with soft footfall and the growth of value-led competitors, things like Greggs. A lot of people thinking, what value-led competitors are you talking about here? But yeah, Greggs, and I think McDonald's do a fairly decent cup of coffee. Owner Coca-Cola is thought to be looking to sell the chain for $2 billion, which is far less than the $3.9 billion it paid to purchase it in 2018 from the previous owner, Whitbread. Now, of course, why this interests me, I used to work there, as I said. It used to, I think, be the best when I did. We used to have to go to Costa College for a couple of days, learn all about it, educate the public. This was a long time ago, by the way. But it's lost its way. It massively lost its way. And I don't know if it's previous owners, it just became almost a bit sort of McDonald's-y of coffee shops. I don't know what its USP was. But also, I remember 2 years ago listening to David Coombs of Rathbones talk about coffee pushing £4. And at some stage, with any investment, you can start thinking, what am I actually getting in return for this? Yes, a quick caffeine hit, but for £4? And now I'm seeing coffee for £5. And I think, Lee Boyce, at what stage will we go into a coffee shop and think £5 is outrageous for something that in about 2 hours we're just going to wee out?
Wow, that's If we thought like that about a lot of things, Georgie, I think we'd end up not doing anything. Wow, that was something. Look, I thought this story is really interesting. It's a talking point. I think that Costa, as you say, was, you know, probably the coffee shop darling of about 10, 15 years ago. But I think if you step into a Costa now, and this is just personally speaking, I feel like they feel a little bit dated. I feel like, you know, they look a bit like they're in an airport. I can't quite describe what I mean by that, but there's something like not quite welcoming about them. I don't know what it is.
And
actually, I've got experience with Costa as well. I was just looking back at this story. In 2017, I went to Basildon, where Costa built its new roastery. So it's where it gets the beans in and it roasts all the beans. £38 million they paid to build this roastery. And I remember meeting the guy that does the taste test, right? He kind of like tests all of the beans and all that kind of thing. And his tongue was insured for £10 million. Story. It was really interesting, and I learned loads about coffee and how it was made and how they do it. And a really interesting company. I think what's happened is that they've fallen behind. It's actually two things that happen. I think there's a shift, like me, towards supporting more independence. So I think that you kind of like, oh, I can get a Costa anywhere. Whereas if you go to like a new town or you go to your local high street, you might want to support your local coffee shop where you go, actually, it's a 50p more, but it's a better coffee or it's a better experience, and you get to know the people a bit more. And I think there's a little bit of that going on. And then there's some of the chains that have come out that feel a little bit like that, that feel a little bit kind of more independent-y when they're probably not. I'm thinking things like Black Sheep, Grind in London. And it's exactly, you've hit the nail on the head. £4 for a cup of coffee, it's hard to maintain. I won't pay £4 for a coffee. But I remember saying that about a pint of beer, Georgie, and it wasn't that long ago. I remember going, wow, some places are charging £5 for a pint. Inevitably, I do pay more than £5 for a pint. But crucially, a pint of beer at the pub is a different experience. Like, it's more...
Exactly.
There's more to it, as in a pint tastes different in a pub than having a beer at home. Whereas a coffee, I feel like you can replicate the experience. You know, I'm not saying with instant coffee, but you can kind of do it with like coffee pods, or you can... There's ways of doing it in which I think the difference in quality isn't big enough to justify the price tag. And I don't know what, if it's just me, but I've just seen lots of people at the moment, they do pay plus £5 for a coffee. They're getting like a frappa lappuccino with caramel shot and this, that, and the other. It's not a coffee anymore. People are just buying some weird stuff. I mean, I'm just a flat white guy, as you would probably imagine, but I ain't paying £4 for a flat white.
So I am a dyed-in-the-wool kind of coffee shop drinker, but I think, and you talk about the experience there, which I think is why Costa has fallen down. It does feel a bit like a hospital, almost coffee shop, a bit sterile. You can tell they've obviously not invested money in it. Whereas you go somewhere like Nero and you feel like, I'm not saying it feels like Italy in your high street, but at least they've made an effort with the decor. Like my local one has like a book exchange there and the staff are so friendly and that sort of thing. But I think, again, I go back to being a self-employed person. I spend a lot of time working in coffee shops. That is justified. If I think about how much it would cost to work at a WeWork or some working space, I'm paying, what, £4 for half an hour, or then I think it's justified. But the idea of, grabbing a coffee on the go, sitting on the train, is nothing comparable to sitting with your mates around and having a pint. But I still think, I look around, and you said it yourself, you know, we're not stopping. What do you think is going to happen to Costa, and indeed in 2026 and beyond? What do you think is going to happen to things like these sorts of discretional spends? Because at some stage, the bubble has to pop, surely.
Actually, shout out to Cafe Nero. I quite like a Cafe Nero. And it might not be popular.
Better coffee.
My wife thinks it's quite bitter coffee, but I think it's quite strong. But I refuse to pay £4, and I get one coffee a week from Cafe Nero through my phone app for £1, and that's my coffee for the week from a coffee shop.
I use a taste card, so I get 25% off every time I buy a coffee. Okay. There. As long as you find some sort of deal, right?
And actually, the other thing, and you kind of mentioned it, McDonald's and Greggs, the coffee's perfectly fine. It's not like it's going to be like the world's best cup of coffee, you know. But the Greggs coffee is perfectly fine, and it's a couple of quid, and it's obviously cut into a lot of these businesses. I think the discretionary spend stuff, I think that people will carry on buying coffees. People's calorie intakes of some of these coffees must be astronomical. And maybe they just think it's free calories because it's liquid, so it's fine. Some of the stuff that goes into them, sometimes I'm behind a queue and it's like, there's cream going in, there's this going in, there's that going
Syrup.
in. And I'm thinking, blimey, like, this is, it's a lot. But I think people could carry on buying their coffees. It's a treat. It's a quick hit treat. I think that people enjoy. And I think that, you know, essentially ticking over a £4 mark, I think what happens is people go, instead of having three coffees a week, they have two coffees a week. I think it's more of that kind of thing. And actually, going back to my meat resolution, I think it's more about quality than it is about quantity. So, you know, I might be getting one chicken breast and it might cost £2 more than a chicken breast from the supermarket, but I just make it stretch out more. I'll cook it with something that kind of helps bulk it out a bit more. So I'm having that bit of quality meat. You know, it's because it's better quality, presumably it just delivers more, and you just kind of have it with, you know, extra healthy stuff that kind of pads it out. And I think that's, you know, the coffee stuff. I think that there's just too many chains, Georgie, and it becomes, you know, there's too much choice. You think about all of the chains, then all in the independents. The high street has been absolutely bombarded with coffee shops, and there's got to be a kind of point where we have reached peak coffee, and surely that is now.
Do you know what I also think has impacted Costa and will probably impact Starbucks, and I'm nervous about Nero doing it, is those machines that you see in petrol stations that serve Costa coffee. Because in my head, I'm going, wow, well, if it's that easy to make, I could just do that at home. And the quality's never as good. The milk is never as nice.
I must admit, I've never gone with one. Actually, Georgie,
But
you've
that's
made
where they're putting all their money, isn't it?
a great point. I'm going to sign it off of this way. You made a great point about a petrol station, right? I live next to, not next to, I live a couple of minutes away from a big BP garage, which is just off the A127. It's a very popular BP garage that people go into. I am constantly pulling my hair out because I want to get petrol, and I'm stuck behind people in a queue that are treating the petrol station like a cafe and going to get their wild bean cafe or whatever it's called coffee and blocking all of the blooming petrol pumps. And I'm like, I see guys come out, you know, girls come out with their coffees, their sausage rolls, their bacon baps, and like, you're almost like juggling all this stuff. And I've been waiting 10 minutes just to get some petrol. And I just think, well, what's happened to the world? Like, I don't know.
So
Maybe,
true.
and it got me thinking, actually, there's about 15, 16 pumps or something like that. I think 8 pumps should be like fast lane pumps where you promise not to go in and buy anything in the shop and do your weekly shop and, you know, because it's got an M&S attached and start getting all your coffees in that. And then, you know, if you want to do that, you can go in the slow petrol pump lane. Yeah, anyway, ran over, sorry.
All right, Lee, apart from the fast lanes at petrol stations, I want to introduce your tip of the week.
All right, okay. Well, my tip of the week actually has a bit of a motoring flavour to it. So I've written a piece for the paper this Sunday, which you can go and read, and it charts my battle with 6 parking charges that we've received in this house in the last 7 years from a variety of private parking companies that have accused us of breaching terms and conditions of car parks, mainly around Essex, Brentwood, Clacton, Wickford. I can name, it's a who's who of Essex of places that we've had parking charges from. Now, I know I say parking charges and not parking fines because these are issued by private parking companies that don't have the legal powers to put penalties out there. All 6 of those parking charges I have had quashed, all of them. So my tip is, if you receive one of these parking charges, appeal straight away. No matter even if you think you've breached the terms and conditions, because actually in one episode in which my wife did breach the parking conditions of a Waitrose car park in Billericay, I really am giving you every single town in Essex here, aren't I? Because I think it was because our newborn at the time was unwell, and I've gotten a bit of a fluster. You know, it's a difficult period of life, which is, I'm just going to pay the reduced charge of £40. And I said, oh, come on, and we'll just plead the case just on the off chance. We just kind of said, look, this is what happened, totally. Like, we use this Waitrose all the time and know how to use the car park and blah, 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 a 2-hour limit. And someone actually came back and said, look, we can see from our records that you do use this Waitrose quite a lot and you've never breached the terms before. So we're going to let you off. So what I'm trying to say is, yeah, I think what happens is people panic when they get letters from private parking companies, and they panic into paying because there's a kind of, you know, you could get it half price if you pay like within 14 days. Just appeal it is my tip of the week. And if you want to read how to do it more have a look in the paper on Sunday, but just make sure you do it, because it's something like 15.9 million private parking charges were issued in a year. And I looked back and it was something like a 330% rise compared to 10 years ago. It's how this modern day blight is just growing. So don't blindly pay it, go and appeal it. If that appeal gets turned down, you could take it to an independent appeals process. If that gets turned down from there, well, you know, you should pay it, because otherwise you could face civil court action. But just wait with your wills and never go there again. That's my motto.
All right then, Lee, thank you so much, and thank you for listening. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee,
you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can leave comments on the bottom of where this story will live. I think you can leave comments on Spotify now, if we've mentioned that before. I'm pretty certain you can. And you can also follow us and tweet us, X us, at This Is Money.
All right, then. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.